you don't have an entire sort of comprehensive control system. And I'm wondering, I mean, it would sort of tie everything together, sort of the glue that holds everything together, and, you know, very intelligent glue. And I'm just wondering, is that something you think you need? Can you develop that yourself, or do you have to go outside to get that sort of capability?
So, I don't know. David, I don't know. Do you want to talk a little bit about the controls on aviation and how you develop them and who you work with and stuff like that?
Yeah. So, in the aviation space, you know, through our, in fact, the one great benefit of this Smith acquisition has been, in so many ways, for us to have so much more insight into our control suppliers. It really has made quite a difference in our negotiations. But, you know, we've been working with a couple of these folks for a long, long time. You take a look at BAE, who provides our FADEC through FADEC International. They've been a long-time supplier of our full authority digital controls ever since they've been on the engine. You look at Woodward Governor. Woodward Governor has been a partner of ours all the way back to the original CFM56-3 engines. So we have very long-standing relationships with a few big players in the controls industry. We challenge them every year on productivity. They challenge us on more productive interfaces to make sure that they can realize that productivity and share it with us. And that relationship is good, and it keeps me from putting working capital into that area of the business where I'd like to put it somewhere else. So I'm pretty satisfied with the relationship we've got with the big controls guys, you know.
Danny, you want to add to that?
No, I think there are elements of controls throughout, and we leverage and integrate with each other. I think the more interoperable our controls are, the better longer term, and we're working on it. There's pieces inside power conversion where we're looking at our controls platform, and we'll leverage Charlene's activity with the intelligent platform business and use that as a base foundation. So
it's Mark Little, who's runs the Global Research Center. This is we've got a big control COE there. I think most of the work we'll do is either with suppliers or through organic development. It's not a great thing to think about acquisitions in because it's hard for us to bring enough to really run it better than the people that are in the space today. Or you're acquiring places that are also supply our competitors, where a lot of value gets destroyed. So I kind of look at it as a combination of supply chain plus organic development, you know, internal development. Yes, Steve.
Just to start with organic growth, you guys are doing, I think, 10% this year, obviously, but ex-wind, it's like high single digits, maybe something around 7%. When we look out to next year, obviously that, you know, that slows a little bit. Maybe just ex-wind, give us an idea of, you know, where you see that, you know, the organic revenue for next year.
I think, Steve, if you look across the portfolio, you know, we ought to remain organic growth somewhere in the 5 to 10% range, even with the impact of wind, as you look at it.
Okay. And then on GE Capital, you talked about, you know, a little bit more aggressively winding down the portfolio. Will you be more specific about what you plan to do in December or maybe at EPG next year? And, you know, can we think about another significant layer of that coming out? I'm just curious as to, you know, kind of the trajectory of how we get to that.
So I think, Steve, when we were together at EPG, I talked about kind of going to maybe $400 billion of E&I and then maybe smaller than that. And I think I'll give you more texture on that in December and then as time goes on. I think, you know, Steve, what I've always said is, look, we have specific kind of red, yellow, green on the portfolio. We're not going to do things that are, you know, kind of premature or disruptive, you know, from a standpoint of just, you know, we don't feel desperate or feel like we need to make big moves. And I just say, you know, things aren't sacred. We're willing to take a look at the whole portfolio and see, you know, what makes sense. But the leaning is definitely towards smaller.
And are there some, you know, chunkier assets in there?
Could
that
be.
Greater than like $10 billion, stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, could be, but more news later.
Okay, thanks.
Good. Yeah, Scott.
Thanks. Jeff, you spoke about return on invested capital earlier and talked about your 12% number and wanting to drive that higher. When I think of all the presentations we've had over the years, you know, return on invested capital has not been highlighted. In fact, I don't even think it was part of your compensation package and your peers for quite some time. And has there been a transition really driving more towards return on capital? And when you kind of the second part of that question is, what is the right number where you kind of balance growth, balance returns, and
I think it's a great you know, it's a great question, Scott. I would say it's a part of the three-year LTIP that these guys all get paid on right now. It'll definitely be a part of the next LTIP. It will be return on invested capital. You know, my view, Scott, is that we ought to be in the top quartile of our peers, clearly, and that's going to be somewhere in the 15 to 20% range. You know, when you look at financial services, the returns in financial services are never going to be as high as they were pre-crisis. We need to be realistic about that. I think if you say, you know, financial services ought to be somewhere, you know, 13, mid, you know, 15 maybe max, 10 to 15% range. And then industrially, we ought to be clearly between 15 and 20% as time goes on. And we still think that we can manage whatever we need to do from a growth standpoint accordingly.
So that, I guess the natural follow-up question is there's been some criticism of GE over the years to being too willing to trade price for volumes. And you've outgrown the industry clearly. Most of your sub-industries you've outgrown over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, but at a somewhat lower or declining margin rate incrementally. How does that change? I mean, are you comfortable enough in the installed base at this point where you can start saying no to some projects on a more incremental basis and being less, a little bit less focused on growth and looking at the,
well,
you know, the total?
Let me ask some of the team. Just give Steve, maybe,
you know,
start with you.
Hey, Tail, now, and Scott, it's always a balance. We do say no on some projects today and have on price. You got to balance that with the overall position you're looking for. But it comes back to you have to have the best cost position and you have to have the best technology position that allows you to get price. What I'd say is, especially as we go some of our longer cycle businesses where you go through the cycles, I mean, price does go through that. But I'd say is our teams do that almost every day. They walk from things that just don't make sense. But you have to come back to having the best cost position, technology, and relationship too.
David, how about aviation?
I'd say the same thing. You really do have to determine, you know, our goal is to be on the best competitive platforms going forward. And so we have to make that assessment, you know, and we say no to a number of projects. In fact, I highlighted one in mid-size business and general aviation, you know, 10,000-pound engine. We get a call literally once a month to do a new 10K engine. Well, that's not a space that's sensible for us when you just look at all the competitors that are in that space and the pricing in that space. So there's another way we can get into that market, but doing it through a new engine program is just not an efficient way for us to spend money. So I'd say that we're pretty disciplined about it right now.
Charlene, the view?
Yeah, I mean, we have walked away from business as we've tried and have pushed price, especially in our lighting business with rare earth inflation. And we make share trade-offs all the time, and it's good for our margin, and it makes sense. So we're very disciplined on price. And as we're launching our new products, we are launching them at higher price points, and we're earning more margins. So the discipline is critical in our business, and I think the teams are executing well.
We'll do one. Danny, last one.
Yeah, I'd add one maybe more in a little different angle. I think, you know, we look at each opportunity in terms of our product and the fit versus the technical spec that we're bidding into. We try to look at across the horizon to make sure that we're very focused in those places that our product aligns best to the customer need. And then also we think about capacity, you know, and you know, what's our situation with capacity and what's going on in the industry. So we do look, you know, inclusive of those variables.
So, you know, Scott, we'll, in the next LTIP, margins will definitely be there. And then, you know, I've been doing this a long time. Anytime any of our sales guys loses a deal, it's because the competition dove on price, right? You know, so it's just, there's a million stories in the Naked City. This is one of them. I think at the end of the day, we got to have margins go up and pricing, you know, the value gap is clearly a big driver we got to have to get our margins where we need them to be. Yeah, Steve.
Thanks,
you're in the seat where people usually have to sit when they come in late.
I know, it's a penalty.
I usually have to come in right in the front.
Yeah, it's a penalty, the penalty deck. Listen, first question around capital allocation strategy.
How does that 45% payout ratio on the dividend, when you think about that relative to the other opportunities, change at all in your mind as you look out next year, given all the policy uncertainty? How are you currently thinking about it?
You know, Steve, it's a great question. I would say, you know, for planning purposes, you guys shouldn't count on any different than than the same payout ratio growing with earnings. We'll see where the tax bill goes. We still have such a big retail base of investors. The dividend is extremely important to most people that own the stock. I think the dividend remains a key cornerstone, and we'll have to see where the tax policy, where all that goes. But the dividend, I think, is really, really critical in our capital allocation plan.
And I guess the second part of that capital allocation question is on M&A. So when you're talking about, look, we're not going to do anything bigger than $1 to $3 billion per deal, more or less, but that still leaves a lot of $1 to $3 billion deals to fill out that cash, spend that you're thinking about. Does that mean that investors should sort of think about something, an experience along the lines that we had a couple of years ago?
You know, I don't really feel that compelled to do a lot of acquisitions. You know, we're in a different position today than we were 5 or 10 years ago. You know, I think if you go back to 10 years ago, we basically had like the U.S. power bubble. We were like a marathoner tripping over the finish line without any juice behind it. You know, we're in a different place today. We got pretty dynamic portfolios, big backlogs, big NPI span. And I think, Steve, it's just when Dan Heintzelman sits down and reviews Wellstream, Wood Group, Dresser, he can peer into each individual leadership team. He can peer into where the fit versus competition is. He can run those well, right? We're not paying for people's goodwill, stuff like that. So I just think our own experience, right, both good and bad, has given us that is our sweet spot.
Okay, and then on the simplification strategy, so this is from my outside-in observation, a major organizational shift from with domain expertise that might have been in some functions before that are now sort of going to more of the GGO structure. So how do you protect on the revenue side? You mentioned hopefully without affecting growth, and that was sort of the comment earlier. Mm-hmm. How do you protect the customer-facing assets and people and resources and all that domain expertise that might have been in the organization that's now being, quote, simplified and restructured?
You know, Steve, it's a great question. I think that what you should read is that the sales force remains domain, that what goes shared services is the back room. You know, we've had this company's just grown massively globally. We think there's huge backroom opportunities in places like Europe and Asia. You know, we think delayering. And then, you know, look, I think if you sat here today and viewed energy management, oil and gas, and power and water, those are three very different businesses, all big, right? They're all in and of themselves big businesses that each have a different competitive set, a very different, and I just think, you know, you can see it, so can I, and it's just easier to operate, you know, even with the fact that, Krenicki was a great guy, you know, a wonderful guy, a great leader, a good operator, but I think we both agreed that this is a better way to run the company, and, you know, sometimes things just are what they are, and that's the way I view the change we made in energy. And as investors, I think you get a sense today of, you know, sometimes delayering, keeping the front end, but then saying on the back end, look, guys, we're going to do accounts payable. We're going to do all that stuff together as a company. That's a way to save money, and that's important for us right now. Yes, Shannon.
Jeff, just to follow up on the 5 to 10% organic for 13, you know, it says, you know, positive X wind orders this quarter. I don't know what that means, but last quarter it was about 3% X wind. So if we're sort of low single digit X wind but negative or flat with wind, how do we get from that as kind of an order run rate to up 5 to 10 next year? Is it backlog timing or do things actually get better?
I think we got huge backlogs. If you look at aviation, if you look at transportation, if you look at a lot of the businesses, you just have massively big backlogs. You've got a service business that's going to, you know, kind of embedded growth that's in that range. So, you know, again, we'll give you more flavor for all of that when we get together in December. But I think we've got record high backlogs that, you know, kind of blend into revenue.
So it's more that than expecting kind of a pickup in the current run rate.
Yeah, look, I don't think we're really expecting a hugely different economy. If it gets better, great.
And then just maybe if you know, for maybe a few of the business leaders, just with the emphasis on margins that you've taken, curious as to when different leaders kind of heard that message from you and started to really behave differently, and why it's sort of all supposed to come together for everybody now at the same time.
So who wants to? Who's been misbehaving up here?
No, I got to tell you, I think we've always been focused on margins in a big way. I mean, that's kind of we're paid for margin growth over time. So I you know, clearly we're talking about it and we've got work to do, but it's been a focus since I've been here.
Lorenzo, have you?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, we continuously look at the product cost, and as you saw from the disruptive cost out, that's something that we've always been doing. You always have to look back and refresh yourself, and I think this is an opportunity of us continuously doing that. But as Charlene mentioned, the focus on margins has been there. As we go out there, it's something that, from a competitive standpoint, we keep a focus on.
Danny?
You know, I think the margin side, product side has been there. The simplification has been, you know, we've really ramped it up. And there's no doubt that when we made a decision to go after energy and delayer it and take the cost out, I think that was a message. When you go down into our organization, 10,000 of employees, that's when it made it real for them in regards to, you know, we're going to go do this. We're doing this in energy management. We're doing it in power and water. We're doing it in oil and gas. And it was clear to the organization.
J.D.?
I'd say on the variable cost line, we are doing some things a little differently. One, we're looking at vertical integration opportunities where it makes sense. We're doing the disruptive cost workouts. We're also architecting the products a little bit differently up front. Rather than to come out and work the cost down over time, we're really pushing the engineering teams to come out of the box with better cost structure. And I'd echo the comments on the structural cost. We've got a lot of embedded SG&A in the businesses, particularly the businesses that we've built out over the last couple of years.
Steve?
I'd say product cost, same thing. That kind of goes on each year. We mentioned, you know, our engineering leader in our business, Rick Stanley, drives over $300 million of direct material product costs out every year. That's been going on for the last 6-7 years plus. I'd say is cost positions, like having the right facilities in the world. That's been going on for a while. You've heard us talk about Vietnam, China, India, Brazil, and such. But I think the area that's gotten a lot more attention in the last 12 to 18 months is, in a long cycle business, you got to put your brakes on the base costs before the cycle hits you. And that's been going on for a while. But I think with the simplification focus now, as Dan Janke said, he's even more focused on, is there a way we can take some structure out that if we do it towards the top, it kind of spills down to the rest of the organization, and that shows up in SG&A cost down.
The only thing I'd add, Shannon, to that is, you know, from the top down, I'd say a decision that the board and I made, you know, before the crisis, during the crisis, everything else, is the winners are going to have a lot of great technology. You know, in the end, I think the biggest competitive advantage this company has is technology. So we made a choice to go from 2-3% of our revenue in R&D to 5-6%. Now, I think that's crested. I actually think as you look forward, but that was a very specific decision that was made at the top of the company to say we're going to have better products, we're going to have more products, we're going to build our moat is going to be one that's hard for our competitors to match. And I'd say that's, you know, that's been a, you know, it hasn't been a year or two or a quarter or two, but that's something that, you know, when you listen to this group of business leaders, there's not one of them that can't talk about their products. You know, there's not one of them that stands up and can't talk, describe a real technical future for their business. I personally think that is so important in an industrial company today, is, you know, that's really how you're going to build, you know, great technology, services, and owning the analytics around your products, and being able to do it, go from Brazil to Turkey to Russia to China to India. If you knew those three things, plus have great cost disciplines, you're going to run a great industrial company. You're going to run a great industrial company. Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Just a couple questions. First, on the gain in the quarter, can you give us some idea of what kind of things you're going after on the restructuring spend? And are those things that would give us some kind of visible payback into next year in the margins?
So I'm going to have maybe Keith correct me if I'm wrong, but it's basically a year and a half payback. About a year and a half payback, Jeff. So it's rooftop reductions. It's the stuff that can give you, you know, pretty good headway into 13 and stuff like that.
Great. And I just had a couple energy questions, maybe they're for Steve. I was a little confused by your comment about the capacity factor going up 10 points drive service in 6, but you said you're up 20 and you're not really going to get service even picking up in 13. I may have missed something in the translation, but can you just give us a little color on how you see service playing out given the gas utilization?
Absolutely. Capacity factors as far as gas are up. I'd say in aggregate around the world over the last couple of years, you're up 10 points. U.S. is up more, as you would expect, given the gas prices particularly low in the U.S. Europe, much lower capacity factors. But, Jeff, you are seeing the units run more. It's just that you now have an average outage interval of 5 years. So if you reduce, if you pop up the capacity factors 10%, you can pull in your outage interval 6 months. You still have to get to the outage interval. So it's a long term. It's good for our business. You're going to be doing those outages sooner. It's just you're not going to show up. You'll see some of it in 13, but you're not going to see a big pop in 13.
And revenue up 5 to 10%.
Yeah, revenue, as I said, revenue is up 5 or 10% a year.
And just one on T&D also. You know, listening to David Joyce say he doesn't want to go in, you know, a 10,000-pound engine, then I think about high voltage equipment. That sounds like a bloody global price fight also. So I wonder really what attracts you to that space in particular and how you plan to kind of navigate how intensely competitive, especially outside the U.S., that business is.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely competitive. There is excess capacity. And that was the reason we decided to joint venture into it instead of actually owning the factories. This way we get distribution, market minus agreement to sell, and we really own and deliver the grid automation equipment with it. And we're partnered with XD, that the China market, as I said, is the largest in the world. They've got a good share position, and they got a good cost position. So you want that cost position so you can be competitive around the world.
And you know, Jeff, it's a great question. You know, when we were thinking about Areva a couple years ago, you know, we kind of studied the world and stuff like that. And I would say in many ways this was a this idea kind of came out of, hey, we'd like to play, but we'd like to do it in a low capital way. We'd like to be able to package it with our gas turbines when we can. You know, and I think this is a kind of a clever way to maybe, to your point, play a tough market in a competitive
in a different way.
And just one small follow-on on that. So what are your ambitions to pull that business outside of China into other regions? Can you give us a little roadmap there?
Absolutely. You know, our objective is that's where we actually own 80% of the world's distribution on behalf of the joint venture. So that's completely the game plan, country by country, where especially where we're building power plants and we have other capability, that's where we want to prioritize. I'd say the feedback from customers around the U.S., Europe, other places has been open to it and positive. So
you'd probably have a packaging facility here in the U.S., Danny, something like that?
Yeah, late point packaging, but all the manufacturing done out of China.
Yeah.
Right here. So, Jeff, I think you made it pretty clear that you're not looking to do a large deal in mining. a lot of chatter about that. But, you know, what is the ambition, you know, the logic of embedding technology within, you know, within the you know, the underground mining equipment. Does the same logic apply to other parts of that, you know, that vertical? I think right now you're addressing one-third of the addressable market. Is the ambition over time to make that two-thirds or maybe the whole vertical?
Go to Lorenzo.
Yeah, if you look at actually the products that we have, we serve about 30%, as you said, and we think we can actually take that to more sectors of the mining industry. When you look at the package of GE products, you know, we can go into the processing from a crushing perspective. We've got the motors. We can go also into the water purification because we've got, again, the reuse of water and on the energy side. So we're actually going and having company-to-company discussions with the customers on how do we work through either an EPC or direct with you to bring the total package. So with the technology that we have, the product portfolio, you'll see our expansion into taking more of a share with the mining customers on big projects.
Andrew, the way I look at it is kind of like the way we looked at oil and gas, which is, we know all the customers, right? So we know Vale and BHP by first name. We sell them locomotives and gas turbines and stuff like that. If you dissect the basic oil and gas company or mining equipment company, they're requisition engineering organizations. So they have a handful of engineers who are basically sourcing components, wrapping sheet metal around it, and making products. So it's not like Intel, right, where you've got 2 million engineers that are deep in like 1,000 different things. These are light engineering, low R&D. So if you plant a few seeds, you put yourself in a time machine, you get out there in 2020, you're going to have a big mining business in GE. It's not like any sourcing manager would ever get fired for buying a product from GE, right? And so I just think sometimes you just assess, sometimes when there's deep technology and you want to get in a space, you got to do an acquisition. When there's light technology in a space, you just don't. And I think that's the way we look at this, guys. It's just not value creating. Do you guys get this? Just want to make sure that, I'm not being critical of anybody, but it's the same way you go through what Danny sees when he buys somebody. David Joyce, his organization probably does more metallurgical patents every year than any company in the world. If you want to get in the aircraft engines business, I'll see you in 20 years, right? When Danny buys an organization, they're not big patent portfolios necessarily, not huge engineering organizations. There's room. Dynamite.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We see all the time the opportunity to bring technology that we either have already or that we can iterate from a baseline that exists and put it in the product. There's clear path on how we can make the technology better and take it to market.
And a quick follow-on to Steve, I think. You threw out that number for the wind installed base of $40 billion, which is huge. Service obviously is fractional right now, but could you maybe just quantify or scale how big service business can be in wind going forward?
Wind business, just give you a sense, the service business right now for us is just about $400 million wind, and that is just at the front end. If you think about 20,000-plus units in the world, a lot of those units were put in over the last 5 or 6 years, and just look how the units have grown in size. You go back 5, 10 years ago, when we got into business, the average reliability units were 88%. Now they're 99%, but you have a lot of units out there that you can back and retrofit, software control upgrade, and then at the same part, the customers get more power on the grid. So I think going forward, as I mentioned, it's going to be the same sort of play we run in our other businesses. So do we see this in the future as a billion-dollar business? Yes, it has the potential to do that. It's just a question of how fast we can scale it.
Thanks. So I want to go back to a R&D-related question in software. And looking back maybe 5 years ago, we would not have had a big discussion about software, but software cuts across so many of the businesses today. And I know you're setting up a center of excellence for software. I'd be interested in how are the businesses leveraging some of the common technologies and where this takes us in the next couple of years.
So I'd maybe make an overview comment and then turn it over to the team. I think it's – I never really see GE as being a software company per se, but I think we need to own the analytical layer around our products and be able to model that both from a standpoint of how the product's performing and then being able to sell incremental service to it. We created, Dean, a center of excellence out in San Ramon, and that'll probably house maybe 500 people that'll kind of do in analytics what the GRC does in material science and things like that. And then, that will probably be inhabited 80% by people we hire from outside the company, from the industry. So we're bringing in some of the best talent and be able to do that. And then the key thing is to maybe, plug our businesses into that. So maybe, Lorenzo, start with you.
First of all, I think what it allows us to do is have a common architecture, and we feed off each other. If you look at the transportation business, We work hand in hand with the power and water business, the aviation business, and the analytical strength is we now have a common software that we can utilize, architecture that we go out with, and the analytics. We all feed off of the same analytics. So it's huge benefit to us as a business having that center, but then also working with the other GE businesses and having commonality.
JD?
The Center of Excellence is helping in a number of areas. The first is the development process and how we use Agile from a software development standpoint. They're really teaching that process across all the businesses, how we architect systems better. The Center of Excellence is excellent. I mean, I'm an ex-software guy. They've done a really nice job helping the businesses understand how to architect their systems. And then finally, there are specialty services that they're offering, like user interfaces, how to define excellent, well, you know, really sophisticated user interfaces. And those user interfaces are things that are of tremendous importance in all of our products. So you see real COEs developing in the center that we're translating very quickly into each of the product businesses.
Charlene, how about you?
I would also add to that it allows us to come up with new revenue streams because we can offer these software solutions as a service using our data centers today. And so we host Lorenzo's Movement Planner technology, and we're leveraging all that across the businesses. So whether it's putting the right information in the hands of a field service operator or putting that information in the hands of a customer, it gives us a new way to connect and get real-time data off our products. And again, the engineering teams within the verticals are using that data for better analytics and more predictive diagnostics, and it opens up a lot of new growth potential for us.
David, why don't you do a deep dive on the digital work scope? Okay, because you know, one of the things I want you guys to understand is that I view kind of 50, at least 50% of this to be about better margins, better cost. And it's not only about incremental revenue. A lot of this is just about how do you make your CSAs more profitable.
So, you know, we have a services backlog of $75 billion, right? We've got an installed base growing to 46,000 engines by 2020. So you sit in a room and you think about how am I going to get productivity out of that services backlog, right? And you take the idea of today, engines come off wing for cause, right? So it could be exhaust gas temperature limits, whatever. But there's a cause, a reason that the engines come down. They come into the shop. We then tear them apart. We define a work scope for that engine, and then we go at it. We repair some things. We replace some things, bolt it back together, normally have a turn time requirement, and we get it back to the operator. We're starting to think totally different about the way that we manage these services contracts in that you instead of coming off for cause, you come off for cost, which means if you really can understand where you are in the life cycle of the engine and what needs to be done in order to optimize the cost point when you take it off and still meet all the requirements, turn time and everything else, and you think totally different about the digital work scope. Now, to do that, you need a lot more data. You need a lot more analytics and a lot more diagnostics to understand exactly where that engine's been, what it has seen during its operating life, and when is the right time for that to come off wing. And so for us, analytics is exploring really, we're pivoting through a new lens the way we think of productivity out of that services portfolio versus where we are today. That doesn't mean we're still not going to be driving, you know, variable cost productivity and services and all of the traditional ways in which we pound out, you know, margin expansion, you know, but that won't be the only way we think about margin expansion. So this is a different layer of productivity for us that just bolts onto the foundations of, you know, traditional pounding out productivity that we do in GE Aviation. So we're pretty excited about it.
Just a couple of business-specific questions, if I could. The first is an update on MetLife. And then the second one, UTX had an analyst meeting today, and the head of Pratt & Whitney made some competitive snipes at LeapX on cost of ownership versus geared turbofan. And just because it's going to be in the news, I'm not asking you to get into some back and forth on this, but I figured you should get equal airtime regarding cost of ownership and the wins on NEO.
Keith, on MetLife, do you want to just...
As you guys saw, we've taken the application that we had with the FDIC for the Industrial Loan Corporation Bank, and we've moved it over to the FSB, which is our consumer finance business that's regulated by the OCC. And our expectation is that we're going to go through the process with the OCC, and then ultimately this will be closed into the FSB, and we'll close with MetLife. I hope we can do it in a reasonable time frame. I don't think, you know, we're going to lose some of the time that we worked on the regulatory process with the FDIC, but we're not going to have the same time cycle as we go into the FSB. So we're reasonably confident we're going to have this closed, and we got to work through the regulatory process.
David.
I didn't hear the comment today, so I'm kind of flying blind here, so bear with me. So I'm going to talk more about the positives of LEAP, and then we'll go from there. First of all, as I told you, if you take a look at the technology portfolio investment that we've done, and this extends back to the GE90 and even before the GE90, it's unmatched. There's no company in our space that has invested as much in technology plans and product plans as we have. And we're very proud of that. And the connectivity with GRC puts us clearly in a position to where we can take fundamental efficiencies in a low-risk architecture and bring it to the marketplace and match or beat the efficiencies of some more radical architectures. Now, we're there because we ground out the technologies to get there. We have the patents and materials. We understand what we need to do in the engine. The GNX is performing 2 points better than its competition right now in service. And so for us to meet and beat the requirements for productivity is easy. I mean, not easy, but it's in our wheelhouse. Now, relative to cost of ownership, let me give you a quick perspective on this, right? 8 days from now, I will put another 1 million hours on the CFM56 fleet. Every 8 days, 1 million hours. There is nobody that understands single aisle, high utilization, durable operation better than we do. We've got more data from more customers, and we've satisfied more customers for more years than anyone ever has. And we're incredibly proud of that record. We understand that Southwest bounces an engine off the runway 7 times a day. We understand that they don't want to open the cows other than service the oil more than once every 5 years. We like it earlier from parts, but that's the demands of a customer like Southwest. The architecture we put in place is the simple, most durable, and elegant architecture that allows us to ensure that our maintenance cost is lowest in the business without complicating the drivetrain, complicating anything in the oil system, or doing anything that would jeopardize the utilization of the airplane. Southwest, if they have a problem with an airplane on the third leg of their day where they expect that airplane to be in 4 more cities, it's a really big problem. I mean, if you can't believe what they have to do to rejigger their route structure in order to ensure that they meet all the customers that are waiting for that airplane, seven departures a day. We get that. We work with them every day. We understand it. And I'm very confident that when these engines go into service, game on. It's time to go at it, and we're ready. So,
and just add a little bit of color. The narrow-body war is kind of over. 100% Boeing, 100% C919, and 50% market share of the A320neo, only because of Scott's question of what's your price going to be and your margin going to be. So, you know, really, we go through the narrow-body conversion with higher market share, and we went in. That's just a fact. A fact. So I can maybe do this with David's. Now David has to execute.
Yeah.
That's how we work as a team here. Yeah, Steve.
David, just to put a finer point on that question, I think the specific comment, or maybe not from them, was that the LEAP fuel burn was maybe running up to, or what we've heard in the marketplace, up to 4% short of the fuel burn objectives. So to what extent is that not true?
Sorry, and LEAP has?
LEAP, yeah, that's what we've heard.
Well, first time I've heard it. First of all, LEAP, first engine to test on LEAP is first quarter of next year. So that's the first thing. second thing, I honestly haven't heard the number, so if you want to get with me afterwards and look at it, but I can tell you it's not true.
The battle's
all of our
over. 100%, 100%. That's a fact. GNX is 2 to 3 points superior on fuel burn than its
competitor.
Yeah. On a 787, that's a half a million of margin for an airline per airplane a year, incremental, to give you a perspective on what the value of that is in terms of us being able to price.
Yep, Scott.
Since we're talking about competitive products, and you know, Siemens is another one that's been out there saying that they're kicking around a little bit. Maybe for Dan, we can talk about the difference between this, you know, the Flex 50 now the Flex 60. It seems like there's still a gap between their base load technology that's out there and what GE is offering. I mean, when do we? I mean, I guess the point is that will the utility base in the U.S. buy the Flex 60 as a base load product? And if they will not, when do you think the timing is of Steve, whoever wants to address this? But when is the timing, at least, of when this this bigger block is going to be available?
Sure. Let me take that one. The Flex Efficiency 50 came out a year ago, 510-megawatt block. The first order we announced was in Turkey, and that customer evaluated it versus the Siemens 8000H. We already got that order. So the 50 hertz, Flex Efficiency 50 versus head-on Siemens 8000H. The second order we announced was with EDF in France, the biggest utility in the world. They evaluated it versus Siemens 8000H. They chose GE. So Flex Efficiency 50 size right now, as well as efficiency above 61%, very competitive. Big utilities are making those decisions, as well as developers. If you take a look at the 60 hertz perspective, then one of the orders we announced yesterday was with Chubu in Japan. They run the unit based on high gas prices and the grid there, base load. They looked at, as you would expect in Japan, MHI. And our Flex Efficiency 60 hertz, which was 260 megawatts, beat a J machine, which was north of 300 megawatts. Base load. Why? Higher efficiency? Straightforward. Now, the question is, are there going to be some people that want above a 300-megawatt unit plus efficiency and plus turndown? And the answer to that is yes, over time. Therefore, under development is over 300-megawatt class of machines. We're talking to some customers about. But people are evaluating today our Flex Efficiency 50s and 60s versus J machines, 8,000 and H's, et cetera, and they're picking GE.
Thanks. This one's for Dan Heintzelman. If we consider maybe the aviation and energy businesses as having the fully developed services business models, where would you put oil and gas on that maturity curve? And how important is that to high teens margin potential?
Yeah. First of all, you've got to break it down into pieces, right? So the first piece of the portfolio, which came in the mid-90s, LNG, right, with compression and turbines. That piece is pretty well developed. You know, in fact, we work every day with between my business and Steve's business, sharing ideas, technology, collaborating. So that piece is doing pretty good. When you look at the newer pieces of the business, though, the drilling. Drilling business, the subsea business, you know, we have decent service business size-wise today, but when I look at them from the point of view of the things that are important to customers, the fast turnaround time when an asset comes offline, you know, we've got a lot of opportunity for improvement. You know, and I personally believe that there are very, very direct lessons that we can learn, especially from David's business, right? I spent a lot of time there, and I look at, you know, the way that process can work. It can be very similar, and we can drive a lot of value into that space, and including improving margins, as you pointed out. Now, it is not the same as an aircraft engine. You know, we don't have turbine blades. In a Christmas tree, you know, but the integrity of the system is crucial, right? I mean, these things go in the water and are expected to stay there for a long time and operate with high integrity. So, you know, it's still a very very important job to service this equipment in a high integrity fashion with and testing it before it goes out, and to do it quick. You know, the demands are going up all the time, meaning this equipment that's out there in service is aging rapidly. You know, we are seeing demand going up, and I can safely say that if we can improve our service performance, we will continue to see growth. I don't see it quite the same. You know, these at least not yet. You know, when I look at the business today, you know, reliability is important. I guess I would say I see it more aligned with the idea of potential for upgrades, you know, for new capabilities. You know, some of these products went out years and years ago, and there's newer technologies that can be applied to them. You know, the BOP is a good example, right? You got the shear, the ram shear mechanisms, and those could be upgraded in a lot of the equipment that's coming in for service on regular intervals now. Regulation is going to drive that even further. The requirements are shaping, and you know, they haven't been announced yet, but it's pretty clear that there's going to be new requirements for how these critical pieces of equipment are serviced, and we'll have opportunity for upgrade. That said, I don't know. You know, there may be some possibility in the future for some more creative modeling around how that works.
Maybe a couple more. Any we good? Okay, we've got a bar outside. We all need a drink, and look forward to more conversations.